The old professor sat on his terrace overlooking the Mediterranean, watching through his spyglass as history unfolded before his eyes. A fleet of decrepit ships had run aground offshore, carrying masses of impoverished people from the Ganges. The vessels, barely seaworthy, contained countless thousands, arms reaching skyward, bodies packed in layers. On the beach below, soldiers burned corpses in massive pyres, some fleeing in panic at the horror of their task. As night fell, the chanting of 800,000 voices rose from the shore. Meanwhile, in Paris, government officials met in crisis as Mozart played on every radio station, a final, perfect expression of Western civilization facing its demise. John Raspail's controversial 1973 novel, The Camp of the Saints, became a cultural touchstone for discussions about immigration, civilization, and cultural identity. Translated into a dozen languages and periodically rediscovered during migration crises, the book has been embraced by figures like Steve Bannon, who referenced it repeatedly during his time in the Trump administration, and Marine Le Pen, while being condemned by others as xenophobic. Regardless of one's political stance, the book presents a thought-provoking, if deeply disturbing, meditation on the fragility of civilizations and the moral complexities of humanitarian impulses. The catalyst for the novel's apocalyptic migration begins at Belgium's consulate in Calcutta, where thousands gather despite a posted decree ending all adoption procedures and visa approvals. A desperate mother thrusts forward her deliberately fattened 2-year-old boy, explaining how they sacrificed everything to make him healthy enough for adoption. "He's not even mine now," she insists, pointing to the medal around his neck from his new family. Hundreds more push forward with children, crying, "Take them, they're theirs now." The Belgian decree, rather than stemming the tide, increases it tenfold. The crowd grows daily, with the most presentable children displayed up front, like a merchant's wares, while mothers with deformed children wait in the back, their hope knowing no bounds. The myth of Western paradise spreads through famine-racked Calcutta, rivers thick with fish and fields bursting with crops. Into this desperate scene steps Balin, an atheist philosopher who becomes the catalyst for mass migration. He watches in awe as his encouraging smile transforms a turd collector, a man who spent his life handling excrement along the Ganges, into a charismatic demagogue. This unlikely prophet begins preaching to the masses, spinning a syncretic religious tale where Hindu gods rescue the Christian god from his cross, who then gives them his kingdom. Together, they build a boat as big as the India Star to sail to Western paradise. The crowd by the Ganges grows to 500,000, entranced by this apocalyptic vision. When the turd eater describes people singing on the India Star's deck as they approach paradise, the crowd turns toward the actual ship moored at the dock, ready to make the vision reality. The India Star, a 60-year-old steamer with 4 of its 5 stacks rusted and broken, sits seemingly prepared for one final act of heroic desperation. That night, Balin and other agitators, experts in mob psychology, sneak aboard to question the captain about supplies needed for a one-way journey to Europe. They orchestrate a collection, with the turd eater proclaiming that the people should gather their jewelry to pay the captain. The crowd responds with astonishing generosity, as even the poorest pilgrims contribute rupees and jewels, all believing themselves part of the unfolding legend. The Belgian consul, bandaged from a stone wound, berates a group of Western humanitarian workers seated before him. "Your damned obnoxious pity," he shouts, accusing them of contempt for their own civilization. He condemns their two-faced charitable work, revealing that 40,000 Indian children have been shipped to Belgium alone. When one admits they've lost control of the movement they started, the consul calls them traitors and revokes their passports. The next day, the turd eater boards the India Star first, his monster totem son's head visible above the crowd like a periscope. A profound silence spreads through the harbor as the symbolic pair slowly ascends the gangplank. When the turd eater lifts his deformed son high in the air on the bridge, each person in the crowd feels personally summoned. The peaceful rush that follows still claims many lives as people fall between ship and pier. Balan, once their benefactor, is rejected by the crowd, beaten and pushed from the gangplank. In his final moments, he experiences a profound reversal, suddenly missing the West he had rejected, before willingly gulping down his death in the murky waters. In all ports along the Ganges, 100 ships are stormed in similar fashion. Government authority collapses completely, with one regiment throwing their rifles into the Ganges rather than blocking access to the ports. The Belgian consul makes a final stand, confronting a bishop blessing the departing masses. Taking a rifle from his deserting guard, the consul shoots a young man in the crowd, declaring, "I'm going to turn off those bright, shining eyes just for the pleasure it gives me." The mob then overwhelms him as the bishop offers forgiveness. The refugee fleet of 100 ships moves slowly southwest from the Ganges Delta toward the Straits of Ceylon, paced by the weakest vessel. On the lead ship, India Star, the monster figure with a bald head now wears the captain's cap and commands the fleet through silent gestures. Below decks, forgotten outsiders, Chinese and even some whites, huddle in dark corners, talking endlessly about their revolutionary plans for the West. Life aboard the refugee vessels deteriorates into extreme conditions of hardship. The ships, designed for simple coastal commerce, become floating testaments to human perseverance. After passing Ceylon, their enigmatic leader makes a difficult decision regarding the deceased, implementing necessary but solemn protocols for managing the growing crisis aboard. The refugees develop innovative solutions for basic survival needs. Young assistants help create alternative fuel sources from available materials, though this leads to challenging sanitary conditions that become characteristic of the fleet's passage across the Indian Ocean. The mortality rate remains steady throughout the journey. The most vulnerable, elderly passengers and young children, succumb first to the harsh conditions and limited resources. Traditional funeral customs prove unsustainable given the circumstances. The initial attempts at proper ceremonies create dense smoke across the waters. The designated workers face increasingly difficult tasks managing these solemn duties, creating memories that would affect survivors permanently. Those who endure lie still on deck, preserving their strength. Many experience vivid dreams of safety and abundance. As the journey continues, the psychological strain manifests in unexpected social behaviors. The crowded conditions lead to widespread intimate encounters, a phenomenon psychologists later attribute to extreme stress and the human need for connection in crisis situations. The fleet experiences unusually favorable weather conditions, which many interpret as divine providence. One vessel, carrying society's most marginalized members, is lost to the sea. The young advisor on the lead ship makes an austere decision, maintaining course without rescue attempts. The situation takes a tragic turn when a Greek commercial vessel encounters survivors. Captain Luke Notaris makes a controversial command decision, resulting in significant loss of life. This incident becomes public knowledge when a crew member later reveals the details to media, profoundly affecting public opinion. The Western world's reaction transforms the narrative around the refugee crisis, making any opposition to the approaching fleet appear morally questionable in comparison to this act of calculated indifference. The Western world receives news of the refugee fleet with remarkable indifference rather than alarm. The narrator condemns Western opinion as fundamentally apathetic, stirred only superficially by mass media into spur-of-the-moment emotions or secondhand feelings. Real global crises serve merely as entertainment for bored Westerners, momentary diversions from routine like Christmas parties that briefly animate the great thoughtless void. In a Parisian Elysee Palace meeting, French ministers discuss the approaching refugee fleet with detachment. When the undersecretary sarcastically proposes placing the fleet under UN supervision as a floating republic of the high seas, funded indefinitely by wealthy Western nations, the president scolds him for joking. Jean Aurel, the government spokesman, delivers an impassioned speech about France's moral obligation to welcome the refugees, framing the crisis as a sign of things to come, a symbol of the rising worldwide socialist movement. The press conference that follows reveals the strategic manipulation of public opinion. journalist Dio orchestrates questions leading to heated debate about the refugee fleet. Minister Aurel presents a humanitarian stance, declaring France will provide aid and proposing an international commission to supply the fleet. When journalist Masha Fech challenges this approach, asking if feeding a million invaders is wise and whether France could resist if they landed, Aurel dismisses the question as revolting. The conference concludes with Dio dramatically dubbing the approaching vessels the Last Chance Armada, a phrase destined to paralyze Western resistance. The media settles into promoting three themes: Western paradise, the Last Chance Armada, and Ganges culture's role in mankind's ultimate perfection. Meanwhile, Australia takes a firm stand, announcing it will enforce its Immigration Act with no exceptions, effectively barring the non-white refugees. This sparks demonstrations across Western capitals with chants of, "Racists, fascists, we're all from the Ganges now." The refugee fleet unexpectedly changes course. Instead of sailing through the Gulf of Aden towards Suez as anticipated, it heads south toward the Cape of Hope via the Mozambique Channel. This course change was secretly engineered by the Egyptian government, terrified by the prospect of a million desperate refugees potentially becoming stranded in the Suez Canal. In complete secrecy and confusion, they dispatch their last functioning torpedo boat to confront the armada. The confrontation occurs 600 kilometers east of Socotra. The Egyptian vessel pulls alongside the India Star, where the admiral observes the monstrous child perched on a giant's shoulders, wearing a gold-braided cap and waving his twisted arms. Through a megaphone, they warn the fleet against attempting passage through Suez, citing risks of larger vessels sinking. When this diplomatic message receives no response, the admiral issues a 5-minute ultimatum to change course or face gunfire. After 4 minutes, he orders a warning volley of anti-aircraft tracers over the India Star's bridge. The gunfire triggers an inhuman howl from the monster child, who miraculously turns his head toward the south, something physically impossible given his deformities. The captain of the India Star emerges from the wheelhouse, makes eye contact with the admiral, and begins turning the ship southward. The entire fleet follows in a great arc, heading due south. As the Ganges fleet approaches South African waters, moderate Western papers suggest South Africa as a logical destination for the refugees, citing its size, 3 times that of France, small population, favorable climate, and economic development. The Afrikaners respond with characteristic defiance, their president declaring South Africa a white nation with 80% blacks and announcing that not a single refugee from the Ganges will set foot alive on South African soil. In a strange twist, South African naval vessels intercept the fleet to provide supplies, rice, water, and medicine, but the refugees immediately dump everything overboard, forming human chains to throw sacks of rice into the sea and toppling water tanks over the sides. The Western press immediately spins the incident with headlines questioning South African motives, some even suggesting the supplies were poisoned. 2 weeks after the South African incident, the Sao Tome airlift becomes a circus of humanitarian showmanship. The Vatican's white plane arrives first, followed by the World Council of Churches aircraft filled with radical pastors. Then come neutral nations planes, European powers secretly scouting the fleet, and an eccentric Order of Malta Boeing with aristocrats. An English rock band delivers marijuana, sitars, and fireworks rather than necessities. Last arrives the ostentatious French National Radio and Television Network jet. When the Ganges fleet finally approaches Sao Tome, the encounter becomes nightmarish. Rather than stopping gratefully, the ships show hostility, nearly ramming boats, throwing back donated supplies, attacking those attempting to board, and even hurling down the corpse of a converted Western writer. This murder is concealed by Dominican friars with Vatican approval, fearing Western opinion might turn against the refugees. The Duke de Ross, a naval veteran who had been on the Order of Malta boat, comes to journalist Mutz Scheffer's office in a rage over the media's distortion of events. The Duke insists the India Star had deliberately tried to ram them, with that goddamn dwarf on the bridge and hostile faces staring down. Most disturbing was the Duke's eyewitness account of the murdered white man with a blonde beard, the body he had seen twice, once when it was thrown from the ship and again when Fra Mutone secretly buried it on the beach. Machefer takes down the Duke's testimony and prints 100,000 copies, paying in advance to override his publisher's restrictions. The next day, Machefer publishes a bombshell headline about a white man strangled on the Calcutta Star, but within 15 minutes, the presses stop. The printers go on strike, claiming they wouldn't work overtime, limiting him to his usual 10,000 copies. On Palm Sunday afternoon, destroyer escort 322 returns to Dakar Harbor after what was officially termed a routine mission, though its true nature was anything but ordinary. The ship stays just long enough for Commander de Pudis to disembark before being placed under immediate quarantine, a measure that speaks volumes about the authorities' growing fears. The commander, still in his salt-stained uniform, is swiftly transported to Paris for an urgent, clandestine meeting with the president and Undersecretary Jean Perret in a closely guarded conference room of the Élysée Palace. De Pudis recounts his mission with military precision, explaining how he located the massive Ganges fleet both through radar signatures and, more disturbingly, by the unmistakable stench that carried across miles of open ocean. The armada was discovered approximately 142 miles off the Mauritanian coast, a position that placed them squarely on their predicted course toward Europe. Following his orders to initiate confrontation, deliberately ambiguous wording that masked its true implications, he had assembled his entire crew on the starboard deck, forcing them to witness what he knew would be an unforgettable sight. Countless thousands of desperate refugees packed onto vessels that defied maritime safety standards. The captain's description of the scene becomes increasingly detailed and haunting. He speaks of children with distended bellies pressed against rusting rails, of makeshift scaffolding creaking under the weight of hundreds, of bodies being quietly committed to the sea during the night. Yet amid this apocalyptic tableau, he notes an unsettling detail, occasional glimpses of beautiful young bodies, strong and well-fed, moving purposefully through the crowds. His crew's reaction evolved from initial revulsion to stunned silence to, finally, a deep and overwhelming pity that would prove their undoing. When ordered to simulate combat alert, the crew performed their duties with mechanical precision until the crucial moment, the order to open fire, even in drill. At this point, they collectively refused, an act of mutiny that revealed the impossible moral position they found themselves in. The mission's final phase proved catastrophic. De Pudis deployed a 43-man strike force to board one of the refugee vessels, following standard naval protocol for hostile vessel interdiction. However, they encountered something unprecedented, a silent, passive resistance in the form of thousands of bodies pressing forward, creating an impenetrable wall of human flesh. Warning shots fired into the air proved futile. The refugees simply advanced without aggression or retreat, their very mess their most effective weapon. In the chaotic withdrawal, two sailors were crushed to death, their bodies lost in the press of humanity. The president, seeking options, directly asks de Pudis if he would follow orders to torpedo the refugee boats. The captain's response is unequivocal: he cannot and will not comply. Then, in a moment of raw honesty, he reveals the personal stake that crystallized his decision. One of the young sailors in his command was his own son. This confession transforms the theoretical into the devastatingly personal. Perret, ever the pragmatist, suggests seeking out career soldiers who might still be willing to fight, while proposing a legal strategy, officially denying the refugees permission to land, thereby transforming any arrival into an act of aggression that would justify military response. At 3 in the afternoon on Good Friday, the Last Chance Armada passes through Gibraltar into the Mediterranean. The fleet erupts in celebration, arms waving and voices chanting in prayer. The monster child aboard experiences a seizure that somehow captivates the entire fleet's attention. Spain suffers immediate shock. Good Friday processions transform from tourist spectacles back to genuine religious observances as the news spreads. Families flee inland from coastal cities, creating two opposing streams, one of words flowing toward the sea, another of people flowing away from it. Near Almeria, fishermen discover 20 naked corpses on the beach, all strangled. Authorities delay investigation, eventually revealing the dead aren't Hindus, but whites, Chinese, and one mulatto Western collaborators purged by the fleet to maintain racial purity. On Easter Sunday, the president prepares to address the nation at midnight. He begins with calm authority, explaining that within 5 hours, 1 million refugees will land on French shores, people of different race, religion, language, and culture, mostly women and children fleeing famine and misery. Though most citizens find it unthinkable to use armed force against the defenseless, the president initially announces he has ordered the army to prevent the landing by opening fire if necessary. But midway through this declaration, his voice falters. After 30 seconds of labored breathing, he changes course completely, abandoning his prepared text to speak from his conscience. In a broken voice, he asks every soldier and officer to decide for themselves whether to accept or reject this monstrous mission, concluding with, "My friends, whatever happens, may God help us or forgive us." At midnight on Easter Sunday, 99 ships crash onto the beaches between Nice and Saint-Tropez. Throughout the day, nothing moves aboard except waving arms, corpses thrown overboard, and endless chanting. As the last refugee steps ashore, a sudden, intense Mediterranean storm erupts, lasting barely an hour but fundamentally changing the invasion's character. The downpour transforms their uncertainty into decisive action. They frantically seek shelter, smashing doors and breaking into every available structure. A crude hierarchy quickly emerges. Those who first find tools to break down doors become leaders, cheered by the masses. When the storm passes, they reappear everywhere, in doorways, on terraces, balconies, rooftops, a swarming mass calling triumphantly to one another. "See, we made it. We're here." Soon after settling, they discover that the coastline is insufficient for their numbers. This discovery sparks what historians would later call the winning of the North, as three-quarters of the strongest migrants push further inland. France has capitulated. What was inevitable has come to pass, with only isolated local accommodations between opposing forces. The global collapse unfolds simultaneously. Along the Amur River, thousands of corpses float past abandoned Soviet bunkers after a drunken general shot a Chinese child. In New York, black militants rise floor by floor through high-rises. In London, the Non-European Commonwealth Committee negotiates demands, including that the Queen's son marry a Pakistani. The radio station transforms into the Paris People's Radio Cooperative as a triumvirate emerges: a black street sweeper, a Vietnamese student, and a radical student activist. Committees form everywhere, even at Notre Dame, where the Archbishop opens the doors wide. Meanwhile, ordinary citizens like Marcel and Josiane surrender their apartment to Monsieur Ali's apartment without resistance. Only in a small village in the south does resistance continue. Colonel Dragasis and a small band of soldiers establish a perimeter, shooting any invader or white collaborator on sight. They're joined by a motley crew of holdouts: the former newspaper editor Machafer, the aristocratic Duke de Ross with his servants, Hamadoura, an ex-deputy from Pondicherry who had warned about the invasion, and Selicaro, a Corsican brothel owner. Their resistance is short-lived. A military plane makes a reconnaissance pass over the village, first displaying friendly markings, but then strafing a town hall. Minutes later, the full attack force arrives, 18 planes in 6 waves of 3. The defenders gather on the terrace, facing their final moments. They choose to die by their countrymen's bombs rather than face the swarming horde surrounding them. The bombs fall, destroying the villa. When guardsmen arrive to identify the bodies, they find the final tally sheet: 312 from the Ganges, 66 fellow travelers. 20 defenders died in all, their names recorded for posterity. The narrator concludes by describing Switzerland's fate. Once mocked for its selfish, abnormal values, it sealed its borders after Easter Monday and placed dark-skinned people under surveillance. Though this reprieve lasted only months, as Switzerland's foundations had been sapped from within by the Beast, at midnight, her borders will open, already practically unguarded. The narrator sits, repeating Prince Bibesco's words. The fall of Constantinople is a personal misfortune that happened to all of us only last week.